You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet here in my individual capacity. We're returning to our series on scaling AI. And this week, we learned that NVIDIA, America's trillion-dollar company, will begin selling H200 chips to China. The justification was that some 25% of the price of these chips will be, quote, paid to the United States of America. I'm not sure what that means, but the response from the Hill was immediate, with both Democrats and Republicans sounding the alarm with concerns that, quote, these highly advanced chips will be used by China to strengthen its military capabilities and totalitarian surveillance. And NVIDIA could be under no illusions. China will rip off its technology, mass produce it themselves, and seek to end NVIDIA as a competitor. This is a quote from a Republican member of Congress, John Molinar, who chairs the House China Committee. Now, the same day these sales were announced, Operation Gatekeeper, an AI smuggling network, was announced. And that smuggling network sent H200 chips to mainland China and Hong Kong, and it was shut down by the United States. So what do we have going on here? Short-term thinking that places U.S. national security beneath AI dominance? It's hard to say. Or is this practical business decision that figures out a way to make money for the U.S. Treasury off the sales of a technology China was already stealing? Now, did NVIDIA go through any established national security review to make sure that selling these chips to China did not create a serious risk to the U.S. national security? Well, tonight we talked to Justin Sherman, author of Navigating Technology and National Security at the Intersection of CFIUS, Team Telecom, AI Controls, and Other Regulations. Justin, thank you for being here and talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to go through this amazing book, but I always find that I think it's best to use a hypothetical. Does that work for you?
Indeed.
Okay. Let's talk about a fictional company that has developed artificial general intelligence, you know, the Holy Grail, right? Or we'll call it AGI. And we're going to call that company ShermanWorks. Does that work for you, or do you feel like we need something else?
Fine by me.
All right. Separately, ShermanWorks also produces a chip with a high level of computing power and speed. It's really high. We can call that the H2002. It's so high that it would enable the targeting of advanced military drone systems of other nations. But more specifically, the company has persuaded investors in its technology that that technology would help defend against the big one, nuclear attack. Now, the company is headed by Chip Wonderboy. He's a ketamine-consuming Wonderkin CEO of ShermanWorks, and he's known for his inability to sit still during interviews. His claim that women, Zoroastrians, and people with birthmarks should not be allowed to vote. And of course, his recent marriage to his pet Chihuahua. You following all this, Justin? Are you with me?
Got a lot of plot points, but we're keeping track.
Excellent. All right. In an investor call, Chip Wonderboy announces that ShermanWorks plans to sell these H2002 chips to China and Russia for profits that are so high, his company will eclipse the profits and technological advances of any company in the history of the world. And he deliberately references Avengers Endgame and repeats a claim that he made to his board that the chips and AGI model will prevent a similar fate from happening to the global population. All right. The investor call links to the Wall Street Journal. Then a ShermanWorks whistleblower reveals a backdoor deal Chip Wonderboy made with the Sovereign Wealth Fund of North Korea. Just work with me here. There may not be one. And it's going to cover the extremely high cost of a rare mineral used in the H2002 chips. And in fact, using a global network of cryptocurrency exchanges and mixers, the North Korean investment arm will send ShermanWorks over $100 billion over the coming 5 years in exchange for a piece of ShermanWorks. So what could happen to Chip Wonderboy and ShermanWorks? What do you think?
It's an interesting set of questions. First is, before we even get to the regulatory issues, is one of the questions you mentioned up front, which is, what is the trade-off here between the supposed economic gains and, related to that, the supposed national security gains of selling this set of capabilities and the national security threat created potentially by giving access to certain capabilities in this scenario, these H-2002s, to foreign adversaries of the United States that could use them for an untold number of different activities. So, we can walk through kind of the regulatory questions, but I think on its face, this gets us to the heart of what we're seeing play out, whether it's the NVIDIA chip sales you mentioned or any other debate today, the way that companies are framing the economic gains they can make as a national security benefit against the questions about risks.
This whole issue that I think I was trying to allude to, and you understand very well, which is that a lot of this technology gets stolen and reverse engineered anyway. And the question is, do we make a profit from it and try to deliver something to the economy or not? But what should he have, if he hadn't been so high on ketamine, what probably should Chip Wonderboy and Sherman Works have considered right from the get?
One of the first questions, and this segues well from your point about the trade-offs here, is the export control regime, right? Is are we selling a technology to a designated adversary? In this case, certainly it sounds like China and Russia, and there's maybe some North Korean sovereign wealth money mixed in the pot that the U.S. government has designated as a dual-use technology of concern or a technology that would provide an adversary with concerning military or defense or intelligence capabilities. And so, of course, many of these chips, at least historically, have been subject to various U.S. export controls, often run out of BIS at the Commerce Department. But in this scenario, that would be one of the first questions is, do we need to get approval from the U.S. government before we go forward with this transaction? Is it entirely clear to go sell? Is there some nuance there? I don't know if this scenario is anything like we're seeing with NVIDIA. I think there's certainly a question mark around, can we just outright sell, or do we need to talk with the White House, even if that means, providing a cut of the profits in order to effectuate that sale going forward?
The other thing is, we have in this scenario, we have a foreign investor, a foreign sovereign wealth fund. What other sort of interagency concern does that implicate?
So this implicates another key part, as I talk about in the book, which is sort of, it's a historical review. It also looks forward, but it's structured around different tools in this growing governance toolkit for technology. And so the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States is certainly one, CFIUS, that comes to mind, a committee with which undoubtedly many, many, many listeners of the show are well familiar, set up actually 50 years ago this year to look at investments coming into U.S. companies for potential national security risks, for various other considerations, but national security being a key driver. And this comes to mind here for a couple of reasons. One is in the scenario you mentioned, you have the sovereign wealth fund of North Korea, certainly a U.S. adversary by all the lists that are created. DPRK is always on these lists as a U.S. adversary, putting money into a technology company that is using things like rare minerals, is building capabilities like these H-2002 chips, is ostensibly then using or allowing others to use these capabilities to do things like train AI models, or the AGI, I should say, whether Terminator style or chatbot style, take your pick. So CFIUS would be triggered there in many cases because certain transactions over a certain size need to go through a reporting process to the U.S. Treasury Department. So the Treasury Department can conduct one of a variety of deeper and longer or shorter and quicker reviews into whether or not that transaction should be approved, should be blocked, should be approved, but with conditions, usually mitigations for national security risks. But the other reason I mention it is because CFIUS, being stood up in 1975, was around the time very focused on physical goods and components. So there were technology issues then, certainly. The Reagan administration, for example, was very worried about Japanese investments in the U.S. semiconductor industry, actually. But a lot of it was things like, what if the Soviets come in and buy all the steel, and then we need to go to war and make tanks, and now they own all the steel, and they've been sabotaging our steel plants, right? So it was sort of very physical goods driven, and it was not until the late 2000s and then 2018, with an overhaul of some of the CFIUS authorities, that Congress really said, we're in an era now where a lot of this has to focus on not just protecting physical goods, but protecting data, protecting technology, protecting the U.S. tech supply chain, and all of the ways that investment could get you troubling access to those sets of data or those technologies. So all to say, there are several potential serious issues here that we've seen in recent years, to include the rare mineral component of the supply chain, to include the chips, to include, for instance, even things like the data. If this company is indeed developing AGI, perhaps they themselves hold, or their supply chain gives them access to really proprietary data sets that an investor might potentially access. So there's all kinds of ways that CFIUS could come in. I'd be concerned if I was CFIUS here, hearing that the DPRK now has a sovereign wealth fund that they're using to pump $100 billion into this company. Clearly, they have an interest in the technology.
Let's talk for a second about commerce's information and communications technology and services supply chain powers. Are they somehow implicated here? And what is that?
I told them they needed a longer acronym and they couldn't come up with one. So here we are. But I'm kidding, of course. This is a program that was only recently stood up. It took a number of years to come into place across multiple administrations and delayed regulatory processes. But essentially, we have, as we said, export controls, we have CFIUS, we have other programs that are not as related here. Perhaps we won't get to, like Team Telecom, the interagency group advising FCC on telecom licensing and the security risks. So this program was stood up, this ICTS supply chain program you mentioned, out of the Commerce Department to basically say, okay, if a foreign adversary, let's just say China here, invests in a certain tech company to steal something, we've got that covered with CFIUS generally. If they attempt to buy it directly from the company and they're on a sanctions or an export control list, we've got that covered with that program, right? But what about if technology company in an adversary country is instead selling their own products or services, providing their own products or services in the US market as part of the US tech supply chain and isn't already covered by those other programs? And so the example I'll go right to, which is the first time this power was used in the summer of 2024 at the tail end of the Biden administration, is vis-a-vis Russian cybersecurity company Kaspersky. This is one that, again, I'm sure there are folks listening to this who were involved with this process, right? This was around 2017, 2018, where the US government banned the use of Kaspersky antivirus on federal government systems, which I think made complete sense. There had been innumerable reports at that point in time at Kaspersky allegedly aiding Russian intelligence collection because they've got this great antivirus on all these computers that gives them access to all the files and all the permissions, right? There had been, we don't even need to go down the list of how many examples by that point in time of the Putin regime coercing companies broadly. So there was a concern of, you know what, if this is on government systems, it's bad. But then actually, it's still a risk on commercial systems. It's still a risk on critical infrastructure systems. Or what about if a media organization was using it or something? So Commerce issued a directive with this new authority that actually allowed them to effectively ban the use of Kaspersky antivirus products in the United States market writ large. And so it's really interesting. It's because of the breadth of the program. It's pretty broad because of the ability to ban from a market. It raises really interesting process and transparency questions, declassification questions. But all to say, and I fully agree with the Kaspersky ban, but all to say here, when we're talking about what are the implications? I think this is a place where, again, if you are the Commerce Department, you are looking at a critical tech company like this fictional one that built an AGI, you might want to say, you know what, are there, let's say, Chinese company components in this supply chain that we find concerning? And we might want to issue a directive that says, hey, companies in the US don't use this anymore, right? Or maybe that North Korean wealth fund separately invested in, I don't know, a mobile app that's on the Google and Apple app stores, hypothetically. And then similarly, there's a concern about, well, people use that app to interact with the AGI system, and doesn't that give North Korea access to all the queries, right? So you have these kinds of scenarios where maybe it's not a clear investment activity that CFIUS covered, maybe it's not an export that's controlled, but you're in that middle zone, and this is where the commerce supply chain power gives the government pretty broad authority to come in and look at those kinds of questions.
I think it makes national security professionals quake in their boots when they hear some of the things that people from countries of concern are interested in investing in the United States. It does seem pretty strategic a lot of the time. You mentioned data, and there's something called the Bulk Data Transfer Program. I think it might be helpful for people who don't practice in this space to understand, first of all, what is this bulk data why does anybody care about it? What's the value of it? And you can even address that in the context of development or feeding of AI models.
Well, I'm biased. I worked heavily on the program, but I think it's an interesting program because, again, it gets at one of these potential gap areas in the toolkit, and I'll run through it. I certainly know on this show you've had folks on to talk about it before, and I'd recommend those episodes as well. But this program was looking at, essentially, we have in the U.S., putting it lightly, not the strongest data privacy regime in terms of the commercial sector. There's a lot of debate about, rightfully so, about government privacy issues, intelligence collection, domestic policing, and so forth, but we really are not pretty well positioned compared to other countries in terms of having a comprehensive, you know, one standard federal consumer privacy set of laws. So all to say, we have a lot of companies, including data brokers, companies in the business of buying and selling data, as well as ad tech companies and others that are essentially constantly building huge databases on U.S. consumers, transmitting or selling that data to a wide range of entities as part of routine business practice, or in fact, as part of the core business model. And so when you hear that and you think about, for example, the fact that there are companies that collect phone pings and sell massive databases of those phone GPS pings such that you can track, and I'm not making these numbers up, you can track hundreds of millions of devices within one system every 15 seconds across the entire continental United States, right? So, or you have data brokers that amass enormous amounts of health and financial data, including identified by name, on members of the U.S. military is another real example. So akin to the export control conversation, there was a series of conversations in the last few years in the U.S. government to say, what if an adversary wants to get access to that, right? We know that certain adversaries, particularly China, Russia, Iran, North Koreans as well, but are prolific, China especially, at cyber espionage, stealing tons of data. But A, maybe you want to buy data somewhere because it's cheaper. You know, there's sort of this Hollywood idea that cyber operations, you know, or somebody with pink hair or with a hoodie in a basement, you know, typing furiously for 5 minutes and then they're into the system, right? Like, these are expensive activities that take time, that take planning. Well, what if we could go in the front door and we could buy it from one of these companies? I did a study once where we bought thousands of active duty U.S. military service members' data, including special operations forces, for like a couple thousand dollars. So we're really talking about almost nothing. And so all to say, this program at DOJ was stood up to basically say, we're going to create a sort of export control or OFAC style regulatory regime for bulk data. And so what is it? It's a very, very long rule, but the simplest way I usually describe it is there's two categories of the rule. There's restrictions on sale and then restrictions on certain kinds of transfers. But basically, the key question is it certain kinds of government-related data? For instance, GPS pings on a government facility or military base, can't sell that at all. And then if it's not directly related to government personnel, it's on American citizens broadly, then there's a table of where the threshold is, right? Where's that line of what's too much? It's much lower for genetic, it's much higher for financial. So all to say, it won't fix all the problems. Certainly, there's lots of issues with the laws that we're dealing with because this was created by executive order. All to say, in a case like this, when you have, this is the kind of scenario it's meant to look at, where let's say you have a company that has built this crazy supposed AGI model and has a ton of data, and they're transferring all of that data to their different business partners, including some in other countries, right? Maybe they transfer it to a business partner in India because they want the data formatted. And this company in India is just rock stars at formatting and cleaning up that data. They transmit all of it there. It gets transmitted back. By the way, this is very common in the AI sector, also ad tech and various others. This data cleaning problem is immense. So they'll do that. Let's say they share it with a partner in Singapore that does a bunch of additional data analysis. And obviously, Singapore has amazing tech companies there. They've got a really interesting data hub. There's also a lot of Chinese tech companies in Singapore. So, you know, you might have scenarios where if this company is transferring Americans' data or government data in bulk as part of their business activities, they might also have to comply with these regulations, which might mean either A, not selling at all, or B, if they're going to sell, much like in an export control scenario, getting a license or getting some set of permissions from the U.S. government to be able to go forward with that sale in a way that doesn't seriously harm U.S. national security interests.
The issue of sort of offshoring bulk data in order to put it in a usable format, It seems to me just inherently a problem, definitely a business model that needs to be developed here at low cost. We've talked a lot about sort of incoming investments and exfiltration of data, exfiltration of U.S. technology, sort of an intellectual property. But are there outbound investment screening programs that are at issue or implicated by this? And do such outbound investment screening programs exist? We heard at the beginning of this administration quite a lot of talk about that. What is the status?
Well, and I just want to make one additional comment based on what you just said, which is right on point. I do think there's a private sector or some other solution here around, you know, U.S. companies or friendly countries building out those data sorting and so on capabilities, because you know, you can just live purely in like the private sector, you know, unclassified side. And there's a million horror stories that you hear all the time. I heard one the other day of a company saying, oh, yeah, we used to have these people in China manage this and such process. And I don't see what the problem was. And you sort of think, really? Because when it's, you know, cybersecurity credentials or something, you probably need to pick up the newspaper or, you know, go read the Wall Street Journal on a random Tuesday and learn about how that's dangerous. So I think you're right on point there. The outbound screening program is kind of the inverse of CFIUS of sorts. So rather than, okay, who's investing in the U.S. tech sector, are there U.S. companies that are putting money towards foreign actors that end up doing things that are really damaging to U.S. interests, whether that's national security or that's human rights? And so this was stood up basically. There were at least two prominent public studies that came out, one from Georgetown's Center for Security and Emerging Technology in 2023 that found a bunch of U.S. companies investing in China's AI sector and sort of talked about, interesting, look at where the money's going and what are these companies then doing with that funding. For example, you know, about 21% were building general purpose tech, 16% was business tools. But then more damning, the House China Committee published a report a few months later that looked at several specific named U.S. venture capital firms and matched their investments to specific Chinese companies, including one firm that had an internal memo favorably saying, oh, isn't this great that this AI tracking technology is used by the Ministry of Public Security in China, of course, which had been tied in news reports to repression of the Uyghurs. You know, there was another company that invested in and helped exit, by the way, so they helped them grow to multiple Chinese firms, including one that is a known bad actor in the cybersecurity area, and then BGI, the Chinese genetics company that's the source of concern. So again, folks can go check this study out, and I'm sure many have read it already, but this really catalyzed the idea that, you know what, clearly not every company is doing this, but there are some that are putting money towards concerning overseas activities. We have to curtail it. So the outbound program is not entirely dissimilar from CFIUS at a conceptual level, right? If you're going to go through with a transaction, there's some reporting process, there's some vetting process, it could be blocked potentially. But there really are a couple of key differences. One is that the program is only focused currently on investments in China. So it's not the typical four we see of Iran, North Korea, Russia, China, it's just China. And this, to me, makes sense. And the logic of the folks who wrote the regulations, as they've said since, was very much, well, there's a million sanctions on Iran. Who's investing there, right? Despite this hypothetical, you know, what North Korean AI sector, right? Like, it's not as if that's going to be something we're concerned about. We're really worried about China. And so that's one key difference. And then the second is within the China focus, it's not looking at investments in anything in China. It's looking specifically at investments in three categories of technology: semiconductors and microelectronics, quantum, and AI. So all to say, I think it's an important program. It's stood up to do the inverse of this scenario we're talking about, right? Such that if there was a U.S. sovereign wealth fund or a huge U.S. private equity firm, right, that said, hey, I love this North Korea GPT company and I'd really love to pump $50 billion into it, right, that this committee might say, if it had North Korea in its list too, might say, you know, we're actually concerned, right? Sure, there will be commercial uses of that AI, but what else are they going to use it for? So that's kind of the purpose of this program. And I think while not directly applicable in this case, it's just the flip side. It's the, if you inverted this story, that's the kind of risk that the program is designed to address.
When you are looking at sort of the flow of money at this exact moment appears to be kind of moving between U.S. companies and not sort of in the direction of China, Have you thought about what new processes might at some point need to be established in order to manage this shifting topography and speed of innovation?
I have, and of course it's so tricky, and so I argue a few things, at least in this book. One is that I think there are lots of areas where companies can learn from the U.S. government. For example, I went back and read basically every regulatory process document in the last 50 years for CFIUS. And basically over and over, every single time that the committee has been modified in some form, companies say basically the same sets of things, which are, we want explicit lists of the risk criteria you're using. We want allow lists and deny lists, right, of what's good to go and we don't have to worry and what's something we shouldn't do at all. And they want a lot of that information up front. And consistently, CFIUS has said no to that. And this also actually has happened with other programs too. The same thing happened with the bulk data program. And I've also been in non-government meetings where telecom companies going through the Team Telecom process or banks dealing with CFIUS or something complain endlessly about, you know, oh, they always say it's classified and why can't we understand what's going on there and why won't they just tell us, right? And you can tell by my tone that I don't find that very persuasive. So that's the first thing I argue is there's a lot that companies can learn from the government, right? One is a lot of this relates to national security issues. So obviously there's some element of classification. Some of this you're just not going to be able to read, right? That's just the reality. Two is risk is contextual. A lot of companies across these programs complain, well, there's a lot of questions we get up front that then become five times longer as we go. And it was one set of questions this time, and it's a different set of questions the next time. And so again, I think that's where they can learn from national security experts. And that's a totally understandable frustration. The government folks would actually love to have one standard set of questions they could just copy paste every time. But risk is contextual, right? Like we're talking about. You might worry about one country getting a capability and not care if another gets it. You might worry about one company today and then not worry about them tomorrow. You might get new intelligence tomorrow that tells you something that changes the calculus. So when these processes are meant to unearth issues in a transaction or in an export control sale or something, it's meant to be evolving. So there's some that companies can learn from government. And then I argue the flip side, right, that there are certain ways that government, I think, can be more transparent with industry about these processes. I think that CFIUS has done a terrible job in this area for many years. It's known as sort of a black box process. You know, there could be more consistency. There can also be more transparency and engagement. I think that Team Telecom's an example of making progress here. They've started in recent years posting short blogs to explain why they make a certain decision. I hope that more programs take that note. I mentioned the Kaspersky ban. Commerce there had a great post where they explained in bullets, here are the five reasons we think it's a national security risk. And the last thing I'll just say, just to take us back to where we started, is it is so difficult to draw these lines around what's the economic benefit, what's the security risk. And I think that the point you raised is one that comes up frequently in this debate about, well, aren't they going to get it anyway? Russia has gotten more chips since the war imported than before the war. So why are we doing export controls? Or China still got this thing. Why are we doing export controls? And that's an important question. And I think that's where we get back to, well, first of all, this debate has been happening for the entire history of export controls, which predate the United States, like they are colonial. But they're not meant to be perfect, right? Much like if the KGB and the Cold War wanted to get something, they're going to get something, right? If the Chinese government really, really wants to get into, you know, my phone or that company's network or such and such, they're going to, right? But it's a question of at what cost, instead of doing what else? They don't have unlimited budget, right? So I think that we need to have more of that conversation in these debates is the word friction. What friction are we introducing to that adversary? Is it more costly for China to steal the chips through this network that the DOJ just did excellent work exposing and shutting down? Or is it cheaper for them to buy it directly from a U.S. company, right? So rather than do export controls work or not, we need to avoid those binaries as much as we can. Instead, think about the friction that we are creating for adversaries and where we want that friction to lie.
Yeah, I think on the topic of sort of the moaning that comes from the private sector, I think a lot of that is fair because they want some predictability. You know, they're trying to raise capital, they're trying to maintain a business, and they sort of want to have some idea, like, should I even have this conversation with this potential investor? unfortunately, as you say, it's all contextual. And with technology changing as fast as it does, and sort of our understanding of adversaries' capabilities changing as well, everything is a little wild right now globally. And that's going to certainly have an impact. But I could tell you one thing. I mean, they would have probably a lot better idea if they read this book. You know, it was funny. I was looking around at one point for something that was topically just like this, and I really didn't see it. So this is pretty new. So before I let you go, though, I think it's really time that we play Tech Bro Trivia. I'm going to give you a quote, and I'm going to see if you know which Tech Bro said it. Every time you get it right, you get one karma point that you can carry forever because karma does last that long. Does that work for you?
I love it. Let's do it.
All right. Here's the quote. You could actually unilaterally change the world without having to constantly convince people, beg people, and plead with people who are never going to agree with you through a technological means. So, who would have talked about controlling the minds of people or controlling their opinions through technology?
Oof.
Should I do the
See.
Jeopardy thing? Do, do, do,
Yeah, do
do.
the Jeopardy thing. Let's keep it.
Do, do. You want me to drop a hint? You want a little hint?
You know what? And I'll say who is. So we're really doing the Jeopardy. So I will just do this out loud, which is my initial reaction when I hear anything creepy and mind control-y is to say Mark Zuckerberg. But these days, and by the way, you can go read about Facebook and China in the book and all some of the stuff going on there. But I'm kind of getting, was that Alex Karp?
Wow, I want to give that one to you. But interestingly enough, this gentleman has a German surname, and I believe his grandparents emigrated to South Africa from Germany. An interesting choice. Let's not dig too deep. But
Peter
yeah,
Thiel.
Peter
There
Thiel.
you go.
Here's the next one. Our
Okay.
product is used on occasion to kill people.
I don't know if I need to repeat guess who I
You
just
can, you can, you
who
can,
I
you know, if
did.
you've already guessed and you can always trot that
Oh.
out. I mean, would you want your CEO saying this? I don't know. Maybe that's me.
No, I don't think you would want your CEO saying that. As many listeners know, advising CEOs is an interesting game. Some sort of have that sense of, okay, we offer something that we believe is valuable, but we're not going to quite say things harshly, and then some that don't. You've got me in a, yeah, who is that one?
It's Palantir's Alex Karp.
Oh, all right.
You
Okay.
attributed the first one to him. This is really good. Okay, here's another one.
All right.
All right, we record it so no one can see it. Citizens would be on their best behavior because we're constantly recording and reporting everything. He's been in the news this week, and not all for good things. And he was in the news the week before that because of a big business deal that he was trying
Oh,
to.
yeah. I'm going to say, I think I know who this is. Is this Larry Ellison?
You're very good. Oracle's Larry Ellison. Okay, here's the last one. This may be a trick question.
Okay,
All right,
okay.
here's the question. If you want to keep a secret, you must also hide it from yourself.
Is this, are we still in tech bro land?
Yeah, we left it. We're gone. Classic literature now.
Oh, okay. I hear classic, I'm thinking Shakespearean, but perhaps
Yeah.
is this
Modern classic.
an Orwellian
It
time?
is. My
All right.
God, that is straight out of 1984. Excellent work here. Well, I'm super glad you came in. You can find Justin's book on Amazon and other vendors. We're going to hyperlink in the notes to this cast. Justin Sherman is the founder and CEO of Global Cyber Strategies, a Washington, D.C. based research and advisory firm, and they focus on cybersecurity, privacy, tech policy, supply chain, and geopolitics for the public and private sector. He also teaches at Georgetown, and you've listened to him, and you know he should teach. And he's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Justin, it's been great to talk to you tonight. Thanks for writing the book. And I think people would probably be pretty smart to think of picking it up. And I hope we see you again in a few months because I know you're working on something else we will not reveal during this cast. But I am very much looking forward to having that conversation with you sometime in the future.
Yeah, as I said to you before, long-time listener, first-time caller, as they say. So, big fan of the podcast, and thanks again for having me on.
Our pleasure. All right. Thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon. Like and share this episode with a friend. It's not because we're just crazy about technology, but the truth is, we try to have civilized discussion here that's intelligent, and that's the way to amplify our content. Remember, a key part of our national security is our unity, and when we can't agree, we can certainly agree to listen to one another. And part of that is having difficult conversations about the national security risks. posed by some of the advanced AI and chip development and what that means to our place in the world. And we remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than probably any other, and that's a good thing, as long as we remain willing to engage in critical thinking. Never give that up. The writer, producer, and host of NSLT is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is Holly McMahon. And our program manager is the ever-lovely Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney. Social media and research support comes from Alana Cooper-Smith. But most importantly, we are forever grateful to the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, who pursue the good in the interest of national security without regard for politics or party. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.